Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2015. Time is 2:07 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Satter, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis, Edgman, and Munoz. We've got a full crew today. We'll continue on hearings on House Bill 3001, the Trans-Canada proposal. We'll have a presentation that looks back at Senate Bill 138 from last year. Senate Bill 138, along with the heads of agreement between the project partners and the Memorandum of Understanding with TransCanada, laid out the Alaska LNG project path that we're on today. So we asked the administration to outline the roles and responsibilities of the different state entities as outlined in House Bill or Senate Bill 138, and to remind us all which state entity is responsible for what in the path forward. So along with the presentation, there's a document in members' files from the Senate Bill 138 committee record in 2004, which shows the expected timeline for certain preliminary agreements to be negotiated. So I'd ask that an updated sheet be made in part of the records, which shows where we're at on those agreements and what we expect to have in future agreements. So it kind of compares the charts that we had 3 years ago in Senate Bill 138 and where we're at today. It's the same chart but updated. So that's also part of your packet. Later today, we'll have Attorney General Richards will be discussing the Department of Law's $10 million request in the supplemental also. So with that, we have Marty Rutherford, again, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and Martin Schultz, attorney with the Civil Division of Oil and Gas and Mining with Department of Law, for this part of the presentation. Ms. Rutherford, and we'll do the presentations, and then we'll go to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Marty Rutherford, Deputy Commissioner, DNR, and Martin Schultz is actually going to begin this presentation, and I'll join him about halfway through.
Chairman Newman, as you said, my name is Martin Schultz. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Law. I work extensively on gas pipeline matters and have for some time. We are here to... I'm here with Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford to do a presentation on the roles and responsibilities of the different state entities that are working on the gas line project. And we have a PowerPoint relating to Senate Bill 138, which lays out the blueprint for the state's involvement in the project. I would like to note that we have also provided a detailed sectional of Senate Bill 138. We're not planning to go over that unless you have questions, but it provides a lot of detail about each section in Senate Bill 138 and what the current status of work is relating to that section, the status of the state's work. We also have provided, as you just moments ago mentioned, a table that has agreements to be negotiated relating to the gas line project. Some by AGDC, some by DNR and DOR. The presentation that you have in front of you, the PowerPoint, is meant to hit key provisions of Senate Bill 138. Again, the detailed sectional review you have, but the PowerPoint is to hit the key points relating to Senate Bill 138. Looking at page 2 of the PowerPoint that's on the screen now, Senate Bill 138 was passed in April 2014. As many of you will recall, it was heard during the regular session by a number of committees. It had extensive committee hearings, many experts presenting on various facets of the gas line project, and passed in that session. It provides authority for the state to participate in the AKLNG project. And the different roles, AGDC has primary responsibility for the infrastructure in the project. And as it was contemplated then, AGDC would own the state's 25% interest in the LNG plant. And of course, TransCanada would have the state's interest in the GTP and the pipeline. And we're asking you during this session, as part of the appropriations bill, to fund an amount so that we can Métis TransCanada, and that AGDC would take over TransCanada's role in the GTP and pipeline. DNR and DOR are the gas owners under Senate Bill 138. DNR, of course, owns, on behalf of the state, the state's royalty gas. A very significant change relating to production taxes is that if, and we'll talk more about this in later slides, but if DNR decides to take its royalty as gas instead of as money, then the producers can elect to pay their production taxes as gas. So Department of Revenue would be paid in gas instead of in money. And so those two shares, the royalty and production tax amounts, would be the state's gas share. The legislature has a continuing and very important role with regard to Senate Bill 138 and the Gas Line Project. Contracts of more than 2 years that DNR enters into, and we'll get into more detail about that, have to be reviewed and approved by the legislature. It also amends some other provisions relating to production tax statutes and corporate income tax statutes. It creates a municipal advisory gas project review board, which is a group of municipalities that are impacted by the project, either because the infrastructure will be in their localities or because construction activities will impact their localities. And it provides for a municipal group to meet with the Department of Revenue and come up with a property tax mechanism for this gas pipeline project. And Senate Bill 138 also requires reports to the legislature, and we'll talk more about that. Turning to slide three. Slide three relates to the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and some of the sections in the bill that relate to AGDC. DNR and AGDC work together on many facets of the project, including, very importantly, expansion of the AKLNG project infrastructure if there's additional gas that's available to go through the project. Third-party access so that we make sure that other producers on the North Slope and elsewhere that are not owners of the project can get their gas into the project. And also relating to pipe size, DNR and AGDC are working together on looking at the appropriate size of the pipe, and I know you've heard some of that discussion already. So AGDC's role is they're primarily responsible for the infrastructure, and that's to be distinguished from DNR and DOR's role as the gas owners. AGDC.
Just a little housekeeping. We will do questions when we're done. We have public testimony at 4 o'clock today. It's a 20-page, so we need to make sure we get through this. We make sure we allow for questions and get to public testimony on time. Thank you.
Okay.
Put your first time on this.
Chairman Newman, Martin Schultz for the record, continuing with the presentation. AGDC has authority under Senate Bill 138 to own all components of this project. That's clear under their enabling statute. So, in other words, not just the LNG plant, but also the gas treatment plant and pipeline. Turning to the next section, it relates to the responsibilities of the Department of Natural Resources, and Deputy Commissioner Rutherford will be speaking later in the slide pack about some of these roles, but basically this is a very key provision that's listed on this page relating to DNR's enabling statutes. It gives the DNR commissioner the authority to enter into key project enabling agreements of less than 2 years, and if it's a contract for more than 2 years, which the vast majority of these contracts will be, it gives the DNR commissioner authority to negotiate those contracts and then bring them back to you in the legislature for review and authority to enter into those contracts. It also gives DNR the authority to do what are called lease modifications, to take either royalty in kind or royalty in value for the initial project term, which is expected to be 20 or 25 years, also to convert net profit share and sliding scale royalties to fixed royalty rate leases. turning to the next page relating to the Department of Revenue. It repeats some of the provisions from the other page relating to DNR, just to note that DNR and DOR work together in consultation on these agreements relating to gas supply, gas balancing, marketing, upstream agreements, those kind of things. And also, of course, it affirms that the Department of Revenue Commissioner directs the revenues received from production taxes taken as gas, as DOR traditionally does. The next page relates to the legislature. Again, legislature has a continuing important role in reviewing contracts of over 2 years that the state enters into and giving the governor authority to execute those. Section 77 of the bill notes that the legislature is to receive quarterly project briefings, which have happened and will continue to happen. The next page on page 7 relates to TAG, which is an acronym for Tax as Gas, Production Tax as Gas. Of course, we're used to receiving production taxes as money, but as I've discussed, if the producers so elect, the production taxes can be paid as gas. Turning to the next page, the Municipal Advisory Gas Project Review Board. Senate Bill 138 requested that the governor establish such a board, which he did. It is chaired by the Commissioner of Revenue, and the board is tasked with coming up with a property tax for the gas project, both impact payments during construction and then a flow-related property tax after gas starts flowing through the project. The next MAG board meeting will be after this special session ends in December. The next page, page 9, lists some required reports under Section 73 and 76. Important reports relate to a report that DNR submits in consultation with AGDC relating to in-state gas and the cost benefits and risks associated with a pipeline larger than 42 inches, and that's the 48-inch study that you've heard about. That report is being drafted, and it will be submitted likely in the regular session in 2016. Section 76 of Senate Bill 138 requires the Department of Revenue to submit a report about financing options and also investment opportunities for residents of the state, municipalities, and regional corporations to invest in the gas line project. And you've received an interim report, and again, a final report will come out next year. There's a slide on page 10 about heads of agreement, and I just wanted to include this slide to remind everyone that the heads of agreement was signed by all the AKLNG project participants, the producers, TransCanada, AGDC, and the state. It was signed right before the regular session in 2014 began, in January of 2014, and it lays out a roadmap for the parties and what they hope to achieve, and it describes what it calls enabling legislation in the heads of agreement, which later became Senate Bill 138 that authorizes the state entities to do, you know, what we've been talking about today. So with that, I would like to turn the slides over to Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Marty Rutherford, Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner. On slide number 11, you will see a schematic time of a project timeline that was actually Representative Newman brought it to our attention, Chairman Newman. It was provided in 2014 and laid out the schedule, the path forward. The chairman has asked that we update it, which we've done, and if you look on slide number 12, this is the updated schematic. There's a couple of things that I just want to point out, and those are the differences. Frankly, we're really pretty much where we said we would be. The pre-feed on the first schematic, the one from 2014, indicates that pre-feed would be done by December 2015, but in reality, it has not slipped. It was just that was a goal, but the underpinning heads of agreement and joint venture agreement actually provided that pre-FEED might take longer than and move into 2016, which now the schedule shows, as you will see on the slide number 12. The other thing that's slightly different is that the FEED dates in the original schematic would show that FEED went from 2016 to through 2018, whereas now it goes from 2017 through 2019. Again, it's not so much a slippage as a more current reflection. It was these dates were provided for in the original documents. The original schematic just didn't fully capture that. So what's really important is the construction dates. The old one indicated construction started in 2019. That's still the same in this one. It also shows the end date on the old schematic is 2023. It is now showing as 2025. Again, the underpinning documents actually said end of 2024 to 25 at the latest, and that's really what's reflected here. What is important is that the overall costs have really not changed whatsoever. The estimates are still identical. And so the project is moving forward. I will note here, and I'm going to go into it in more detail on our next slides, that the commercial agreements are not progressing as quickly. And I think we've talked about that before, and I'll talk about it more. The delay in commercial agreements could be quite costly to the project. If we are not able to bring them forward on the schedule that we're going to talk about here in a minute, there is the timeline will begin to slip significantly. So if we could go to slide number 13. So where are we now on the commercial agreements or the commercial negotiations? We are in active negotiations among all the parties, and specifically some of the big ones are noted below on this slide. It's not a comprehensive list. The document you were handed out separately is a much more comprehensive list. And some of these documents some of these agreements are actually controlled. The primary lead is DNR. Some of them are AGDC. For instance, the governance agreement and the expansion and third-party access agreements are really led by AGDC, but the state is very much involved because, as indicated previously by Martin Schultz, we care about our future lease, our lease sales. We care about third parties who are outside of the project, their ability to get gas into the project in order to monetize it. Thus far, as you've heard many times, no one has ever explored for gas on the North Slope. They've always been looking for oil and found gas. So if, in fact, there's a methodology, a reasonable way to get found gas to market at reasonable terms, then you might actually have a gas expiration occurring alongside oil expiration. So we care about third-party access and expansion significantly as a state sovereign. We also are negotiating fiscal agreements, withdrawal agreements, and hopefully the ability to have withdrawing parties from the project commit their gas to the project should they no longer be interested in being an equity owner in the project. And obviously, some of the more important negotiations that we are progressing actively are those agreements that will affect our ability to get to a royalty in kind finding. And specifically, those are byproduct handling. You know, when we say that, actually that's code for CO2. And the upstream cost agreements, the cost we will pay. Since we're not working interest owners, we have to be very specific about what costs we pay to each of the units as we take our gas. We need to ensure that we have a regular supply of gas to meet our sales contracts, our supply contracts with the Asian market. And the lease modifications that we're involved with are specifically about flattening net profit share leases, how we will deal with our current prerogatives to switch between royalty in kind and royalty in value, which will not work in an LNG long-term sales contract environment. So these are all the commercial agreement, commercial negotiations that are occurring right now. So if I could go on to the timeline. And this is simply a list of what steps will are necessary to allow the parties to enter into a FEED agreement, which we're hoping to do, let's say, by the end of 2016. Again, there's the gas balancing and withdrawal agreements, the lease modifications, all the commercial agreements that allow us to enter into royalty in kind, the actual royalty in kind decision itself, constitutional amendment that would allow the state of Alaska to freeze our gas taxing prerogatives for a period of 20 to 25 years, and then to bring you a set of executable commercial agreements by the end of the next regular session. So moving on to slide number 15, this is the state's perspective, just our perspective, on what the necessary timeline will be in order to get to a voter, the general election vote for a constitutional amendment next November 8th, 2016. It's a very aggressive timeline. It's very tight. We've been in these negotiations for some time now, so it is doable. But I will say that every commercial negotiation only occurs as fast as the slowest party. One of the good things about it is if, in fact, the legislature does appropriate the money for the Trans-Canada Preceding Agreement termination, we will have one less party to be negotiating with. It will be down to the three producer companies and the sovereign. So by the end of December this year, we believe that we will have to have the gas balancing agreement in place, and I will note here that the gas balancing agreement actually does not, the state of Alaska is actually not a party to it. We need to be familiar with it because it's basically the underpinnings or the threshold document upon which a lot of other documents rely. So that is something that the producers will have to agree to, and so that we can begin to move all the rest of these upstream commercial agreements forward. So we hope to have the gas balancing agreement in place between the producer parties, and then we would like withdrawal and gas sales agreements so that this project can continue should one party decide they no longer want to participate. When one of the gas lease owners decide to withdraw, we need to have that gas volume into the project to keep the economics viable. That takes us into the first quarter of 2016. By the end of the first quarter of 2016, we need to have DNR's lease modifications completed. I will note here that this is moving very nicely. We don't think we'll have any problems reaching those agreements. We need to have the royalty in kind commercial agreements completed so that we can base our royalty in kind decision on actual data. The differences associated with the field costs, the disposal costs, can make billions of dollars of difference to the state's economics. So those are data sets you have to have in order to make an informed decision about what is in the state's interest in terms of taking royalty in kind versus sticking with our historic royalty and value perspective. After we have the commercial agreements in place that will allow us to take royalty in kind, it will take us about 60 days to complete the royalty in kind decision. So by the end of the first quarter, we have to have the commercial agreement so that triggers our final analysis for the royalty, for the finding. By the second quarter of 2016, we need to complete the royalty in kind, royalty in value finding. We need to be submitting to the legislature for your review the actual commercial agreements, and then it is our opinion that we will have to have a agreed set of commercial agreements and an agreed upon constitutional amendment ready to go by no later than June 20th that will allow us to get to what is important is the November 8th general election for the constitutional amendment vote, and we will be also closing out the pre-feed deliverables from the project. Going on to slide number 16. This is just more detail associated with what I just told you. Between now and the end of December, gas balancing, gas supply are critical issues that have to be completed by the end of December. We will also continue our work on marketing issues with the producers, governance, expansion, and access. And it is our intention, as I know you heard from Commissioner Myers over the weekend, to have the TransCanada termination completed prior to the December 4th work plan and budget vote that will be, if in fact the TransCanada is out, and then the assets are transferred to AGDC so that they can participate in the work plan and budget vote no later than December the 4th. So moving on to slide number 17. This is going to be an incredibly intense quarter. Between January and March, we have to begin to complete these ongoing commercial negotiations. We need to have completed all the royalty upstream negotiations so we can make a royalty in kind finding. And we need to have completed them in executable form of so that all the drafting by the attorneys are completed so that you can review documents that are actually could be executed. I will note before I leave this slide 17 that if we have not by April, if we do not have a good sense that things are progressing towards closure, we will know whether we're going to make our deadlines, and it is my personal opinion. So April through June, we'll finalize the RIK determination. I will say we've been putting the structure together for months now. We've got the entire structure. We've got the background. We've got the modeling all ready to go. All that will be necessary is to plug in the final commercial agreements with the numbers so that we can reflect to you what the implications of those commercial agreements will be to the state for the long term. We will, in this quarter, submit the commercial agreements to you for review. You would have the responsibility to either approve those or deny them in that same quarter, and then the constitutional amendment will be in front of you as well. And again, we believe that the latest date that could go to the division elections is June the 20th. If, in fact, we cannot hit these deadlines, it is my opinion that the entire project will, in fact, begin to slip at that point in time. So I think we've been asked many times, what can the legislature do to assist? I think that it is important for all the parties to the AKLNG project to embrace the fact that we are on a very tight timeline now, that Alaskans, the Alaska legislature, the executive branch, we don't want this project to slip. We all understand that the current timeline of 2024-25 to bring Alaska's gas to market is critical. So a slippage of the commercial agreements, of the constitutional amendment, could have, it really does begin to put the project in jeopardy. So encouraging all the parties, not just the executive branch, but all the parties to try to work very hard to find the middle ground that we all need to have to move the agreements forward is an important message. With that, July through December, we'll be in the final review of all the pre-feed deliverables to the project, and we'll be making recommendations on a full feed decision. And one of the most important and significant dates is that November 8th general election, where we would be, as a state, casting our ballot on a constitutional amendment. So I tried to move through that very quickly, recognizing that there will be questions and that you have the public who will be participating in your hearing here starting at 4. But in conclusion, the administration, we believe that we're complying fully with SB 138, the Senate Bill 138. We have absolutely no recommendations for changes to SB 138, and we hope to provide you with the executable commercial agreements by March, April 2016. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Rutherford. I'll start out with just a couple of questions. I believe you just said that you anticipate not suggesting any changes to Senate Bill 138.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
We go to page 14.
Yes,
sir. Starts out with key steps to feed, and it says withdrawal agreements. Where in Senate Bill, this is supposed to be an update on Senate Bill 138. Was there anything in Senate Bill 138 that talked about withdrawal agreements?
Mr. Chairman, not specifically. 138,
no.
That is a no, Mr. Chairman. But I would like to expand on that. 138 is a process. It does not go into great detail on any of the issues or and only some of the commercial agreements that are specifically that are necessary to protect the state's interest. So I would say you're correct. It doesn't call that out directly, but it certainly makes provision for it.
Okay, page 15. You're suggesting that the state of Alaska LNG timeline, by the end of December 2015, the gas withdrawal and gas balancing, whether withdrawing agreements, need to be in place. Is that true? Is that right?
That is certainly our hope, Mr. Chairman. And as you probably are aware, two of the three producer companies have indicated to the governor that they believe that they could. They're certainly working towards that outcome. Yes.
If gas is commercially viable.
To Mr. Chairman, to ensure that should one of the parties withdraw, their gas would be made available to the project either through a gas sales agreement or a tolling agreement through the project.
Well, we just happen to have our Attorney General here. Welcome, Attorney General Richards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can we get your name and affiliation for the record? I have a question for you, please.
Certainly. Craig Richards, Attorney General of the State of Alaska, Department of Law.
Attorney General Richards, would you advise Governor Walker to reject the TransCanada vacancy proposal if there is not withdrawal agreements done by December 31st, 2015?
Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't advise the governor what action he should take. I would advise the governor what legal actions he can take. So in this particular situation, I believe you're asking would the governor, could, with that clarification, could you maybe restate your question?
You got some background noise. Could you speak a little closer to the microphone?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I said that, you know, as the Attorney General, as the lawyer for the state of Alaska, I wouldn't advise what substantive steps the governor should take. I would advise him what steps he can take. So in light of that, I would advise, based upon my understanding of the agreements, what the options are for the executive branch.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, I believe our Constitution says that the Department of Natural Resources is the entity within the state of Alaska that's in charge of marketing our resources.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct, and so do our statutes.
So the Department of Natural Resources will be the entity that's in charge of the contracts for selling gas and the commercial agreements that are associated with that?
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
It will take the lead?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Attorney General Richards, what do you see the role of the Attorney General's office? Is it to assist the Department of Natural Resources in that, if they have legal questions, to come to the Department of Law to do that? Is it to assist the Department of Natural Resources?
Representative Newman, I think that's fair. It's to provide them with the legal resources they need as their attorneys to answer a whole series of issues and questions that they might have.
So then it's not the Department of Law's job to go out and negotiate commercial contracts?
Well, Representative Newman, part of the Department of Law's jobs is to negotiate commercial contracts on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources and numerous other state agencies.
I think we have a disagreement. I believe that Senate Bill 138 specifically states that the Department of Natural Resources was to take the lead in commercial negotiations We just heard the Deputy Commissioner say that according to Alaska's Constitution, says that the Department of Natural Resources is to take the lead in doing that, in selling Alaska's natural resources. We just heard the Deputy Commissioners testify that they were, it's their job to take the lead in negotiating the contracts.
Mr. Chairman,
I've heard two things now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did mean to suggest there was an inconsistency between what I said and what the Deputy Commissioner said. The Department of Law provides legal support for those documents. It does not make the substantive decisions related to the things that go into them. But certainly the Department of Law, along with outside counsel, is responsible for the actual pinning of the documents and parts of the negotiations. And that's the standard role that lawyers take in any complex commercial negotiation that you have to reduce to paper.
We have asked Analytica and several advisors that have been in front of us as the jobs of the particular attorneys that are involved in this and the jobs of the Department of Natural Resources. We've been told that standard policy in that is that the Department of Law's job is that generally attorneys don't negotiate. Attorneys are there to advise. They're there to write the laws. That it's that they are do not generally take the lead in negotiations.
Mr. Chairman, I think that that's mostly right, although I would hesitate because I think there are some instances, just reviewing how the project team functions, where some of the attorneys, particularly the couple of the outside attorneys, will take the leads in certain negotiating sessions related to the documents. But, of course, it's always subject to report and direction from their client, whether it typically DNR or DOR or AGDC, I guess.
We'll leave it at that for now, and I'll let some others take the questions on this. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this overview has been quite expansive on lots of things. So I will just ask a question, the questions, and whoever wants to answer them. My concern is looking back over 35 years of TAPS plus 35 years of TAPS and tariff issues and all the things that I have think the state has not adequately been represented on, not blaming the state for it, but we were pretty young and naive as far as the things go. We're talking about AGDC managing the governance of the project.
Good donuts.
We're talking about Department of Revenue doing the commercialization of the project. We're talking about confidentiality agreements. My concern is at the end of the day, there's going to be – I'm concerned about people not being able to talk to each other for the confidentiality agreements, not – and putting the state at a disadvantage, and then having something on the table – the RIV decision process, then a constitutional amendment that locks us into something, then somebody turns around, and then we don't actually have all the information we would need because confidentiality agreements prevents us from being told and having questions answered, and then a constitutional amendment that locks it in, which very little likelihood of that being overturned once it's in place. And so could you respond to that? And then the follow-up question would be, how can there be a challenge, a constitutional challenge, when by theoretically the industry is going to challenge the constitutional amendment, but nobody's paid any tax yet? There's nobody has any standing yet. How can you explain that also?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chairs, I'll take the last question first and then pass it off to Deputy Commissioner Rutherford for the first question. I don't, if there is a constitutional amendment, so two parts. First part is that I think the governor has been pretty clear in his public statements and otherwise that it's his expectation that this body and the Senate will have before it, you know, the fully termed agreements to review so that they get to see the whole deal before they vote on it. So it's certainly the expectation that although the negotiations are largely confidential under the existing CAs, that the agreements themselves will be before you for your review so that you can see the full deal package. And that's certainly what this timeline lays out. The second question is, if the constitutional amendment is voted on by the legislature and it goes to the people and it passes, I don't think it would be necessary to have a judicial challenge by the producers at that point because the amendment will be in place. So I had heard talk about there being a potential court sort of test about whether or not, you know, the deal was legal. But I think that that was related to concerns around what happens if you didn't have a constitutional amendment. Could it still be done? And because there is going to be a constitutional amendment, that won't be necessary, is my understanding, although certainly the producers, I guess, could have a different point of view.
Before we go to Representative Guerra, I'd like to do a little bit of housekeeping. We've asked Analytica, who are here to advise us on some of the questions that have come up, and I'd like to make sure that the public's fully informed in discussion. And so part of that was withdrawal agreements. And part of the what they had, and so I'd like to ask staff if you could maybe get copies of this made and put them on the table so that make sure that the public's fully aware of what's going on, because part of it was with the withdrawal agreements, or that at this time of the period would produce major risks, and they even went to the point of highlighting that in bright red, would be major risks for the state of Alaska, and in their opinion would consider it would cost the state of Alaska a considerable amount of money if we were to enter into those contracts right now, and these are the reasons why. And so I just want to make sure the public is informed as we have, has the same information. So I'd ask staff to please get that out so the public knows this in case there's members ask questions as to why withdrawal agreements of sales carry major risks for the state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I asked two questions, and I only got an answer for one. And I had a follow-up for the Attorney General relating to relating to the fact that the constitutional amendment will change the Constitution, locking in taxation, locking in one legislative out of another for lost the term off the top of my head, can obligate one legislature to the other, and that would be the issue.
Well, Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, the constitutional amendment would primarily grant the legislature the power to surrender the power of taxation. Right now, our Constitution provides that one legislature cannot bind another legislature in terms of current tax policy. Many states have similar provisions, some with exceptions, some without. What the constitutional amendment as now formulated would do is it would allow the surrendering of the power of tax for purposes of the AKLNG project and gas delivery.
Mr. Chairman, this is Marty Rutherford. Should I respond to the second? Thank you very much. Representative Gutenberg, through the chairs, that you point out a couple of issues that have been problematic over the years, such as the toll on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. One of the advantages of becoming an equity owner in the project, the AKLNG project, would be that the state would be setting its own tolling structure, and it is specific in the bill that it would be a cost of service toll, which arguably would be a lower tolling structure than a third party might provide to the state for its gas. One of the things that's important to note, and it's on this paper that we handed out, is that we will, if in fact TransCanada's precedent agreement is terminated and their interests are purchased by the state, we would not be entering into a firm transportation service agreement with TransCanada, but we will be entering into a firm transportation service agreement with AGDC. That is one of the documents that would be brought to the legislature along with all this other list, a very extensive list of agreements. And each of these will be, in our opinion, they must be fully termed, and they must be made completely available to the legislature and to the public for review so that you can make an informed decision on whether or not they're in the state's interest.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, would we be able to – I know that one of the key components and the rationales for the confidentiality agreements is the nature of the confidentiality between the competitive nature that the producers have with other locations and how they do business. Would we be able to compare our relationship with each one of them? Would that be an open document for us?
Representative Gutenberg, through the chair, there are a few distinctions. Some of the arrangements, some of the agreements that are specifically between AGDC and the other project participants, the other project parties, might not be available, but all the commercial agreements that must be signed by the state of Alaska that provide long-term commitments for the state will be totally transparent and available to the public and to the legislature for review.
And Mr. Attorney General, that's two dozen donuts. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair.
Got any more phones?
Then Guerra, followed by Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, I think in some sense we're all in agreement that we want to move this project forward, right? We'd like to see it move forward as quickly as possible. And you have this timeline here, but the timeline, in some sense, number one, the timeline is not strict. It's not in the statute. If Exxon says, we're not selling you any gas because we want to make more money on this project and we want you to make less money on this project and things take longer, it's not like the statute says the project's dead, right? It just the project just gets delayed as we negotiate those things, right?
That's Representative Guerra, through the chairs, that is correct.
Thank you. And through the chair. Thank you. And again, we probably all agree that we hope everybody plays nice in the sandbox, but we're dealing with a state that has a constitution obligation to maximize the benefit for the public. We've got three companies that have a legal obligation to maximize the profits for their shareholders, and at some point, things might slip. So repeatedly, you have in 2015 and 2016 what sounds like a very sort of straightforward thing, gas sales agreements. But there is some chance that one of the major oil companies will decide they don't want to sell us their gas unless we give them a better deal, whether we give them more value. And they might use leverage, and then at that point maybe the governor might have to use leverage back, and that's possible that could slow this thing down. Is that correct?
Representative Guerra, through the chair. And, yes, I'd say expand on that just beyond a yes or no. It is critical for the state of Alaska to protect our long-term interests in these commercial negotiations because we are taking on a new level of risk, an entirely different model for the state of Alaska, and it is important we fully understand what it is we're giving up and what it is we're getting in exchange, and the risk scenarios are fully developed for the public and the legislature. So I can say that this administration will not enter into agreements that are not in the state's interest. And that is something that is sort of hopefully understood, that, it's easy to agree to everything, but it's very difficult to get agreement where all parties are comfortable progressing a project of this magnitude.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, the only thing I wanted to make clear, because I wasn't clear, but I wanted to make clear, was this is a great timeline. We all want the project to move as quickly as possible, but if maybe one of the oil producers decides they want to try and leverage us, it may slow things back down, and we may have to leverage back, and this timeline then moves backwards. I just want to state my opinion that I'll withhold that. I just wanted to make sure that folks understood this wasn't a statutory timeline.
But that was your opinion.
Well, it's not a statutory timeline, Mr. Chair, but I do hope it moves quickly as well.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my first question, so for gas and Cook Inlet, do we take it in royalty in kind or royalty in value?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it depends on where we are at any given moment. Oftentimes we'll do a mix, and it's subject to contracts that are negotiated, and then anything over a year is brought to the legislature for approval. I think at this juncture we're taking a mix.
And Mr. Chair, if we could get that in writing so we kind of have an idea, because I've heard we're not taking any royalty in Cook Inlet, so I'd like to know where it's coming from. I have another question, Mr. Chair.
I believe they have 30 days. They decide that every 30 days, I believe. Okay. Representative Wilson, okay, your question.
Okay, so I'm still stuck on the confidential agreement. I was there. TransCanada wanted out. I'm there. They want out. I'm fine giving the money so that we can move on. But how do we put someone at the table with only partial information? So we're going to take somebody out who can be at the table the entire time, signing the agreements, and now we're going to have someone who's going to be asked to go in and out of the room. So try to help me understand how I can know that that person's going to know what they need to know to make the decisions to move forward or not to move forward. And I think that's probably an Attorney General question.
Yeah. Representative Wilson, through the chair. I'm not sure I fully understand your question, but I will say that the people that are doing the negotiations and the decision makers have access to the information they need to make the decisions.
So let me do a follow-up maybe. In yesterday's conversation, we were told that unless the confidential, a specific confidential agreement, understanding there's a lot of them out there, but that AGDC has been told to leave the room on numerous occasions because they did not have the right agreements in place. And that at this point, the regulations that are out right now would also not allow them necessarily to have the agreements that the producers want to be signed. So again, they would be left to go in and out. We also heard yesterday that that is also slowing the project down because of this issue. So that's why my question is that if those agreements are not going to be signed, and you're not going to be able to get all the information, why would we want to put the state of Alaska there versus a TransCanada or another partner who will sign those agreements?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, so I guess I'm just not aware of the factual circumstances you're talking about, in the sense of anyone from AGDC having to leave the room to not be involved in negotiations. But I will say it's my understanding that the parties that everyone has access to the information they need to make the decisions. So I'm not aware of a circumstance otherwise.
Follow up. Well, if you could listen to, I know it might be painful, but if you could listen to yesterday's tape, especially the part with AGDC, and because for me, you know, I want the project to go forward, but to, you know, it was clear to us that they are not able to stay in the room for all the conversations. And I don't know how much of what they're missing, and neither do they, because they don't know what's missing, could have an impact. But I have one other question besides that then. So the other part I'm trying to get over is the $840,000 for another position. And my concern is not more, I appreciate the answer that we got from DNR, but the way it's done from, and you correct me if I'm wrong, so you have a base pay of about $400,000 to $500,000, and then you have a bonus for the other $400,000 to $500,000, plus 20% to move into Alaska, and then the bonus, then the benefit package. So I'm not even counting those. But then I learn as I read is that we can't give bonuses here, and so it's kind of a two-part. My concern is how would you give a bonus before they did anything? But two is, are there other things that a government entity cannot do because they're government, not because it's right or wrong, that may be required in the private sector?
Representative Wilson, through the chairs, it's really a good question. You're correct that in the private sector, the a marketing lead would have a base salary of $400,000 to $500,000, and then based upon how well they do, they get this bonus, and that is not allowed within the state of Alaska. So the the way to try to, the way we've proposed dealing with that is to try to build that into the salary, and obviously the state would always have the opportunity to eliminate, let someone go if they're not doing a good job. However, it is a difficult issue for us because we are now, it's not the only difficult issue, and I'm going to address your other question about what other limitations are there as a government versus a private company. We are entering as a state into an entirely new environment by going as an equity partner in taking our gas in kind, if that's the ultimate decision, than anything we've done before. And the inherent risk is tremendous associated with it. So I actually would suggest that while it would be better to be able to provide someone a base salary of $400,000 or $500,000 and then if they do a good job, give them a bonus, it is more risky to not have a good lead marketer representing the state's interest and looking out for our interests when we are involved either competing or joint venture marketing with some of the best marketers in the world. So I think that that's a minor risk. One of the more difficult issues that the state of Alaska is going to have to face will be something we will try to deal with, but at the end of the day, it may have to be an interesting discussion, is gas sales agreement. As we get into actually entering into gas sales agreement, the purchasers never seem to want, they don't want that to become public information, and yet that will be a long-term contract for the state of Alaska. So there's a perfect example of something that's going to be difficult for the state because the purchasers themselves don't want to make that information public. So, and the other risks that we've talked about before are, you know, should gas prices tank like oil prices have done here recently for a short period of time, 1 to 2 to 3 years, the state could actually go negative where we're actually having to pay. Instead of getting any revenue stream, we're paying to participate in this project. So, yes, this is an awkward situation for the state on the marketing lead, but we really do have to get world-class marketers. We're going to be one of the biggest marketers of LNG gas in the world when this project is in operation.
And if I could just do one clarification. So when you were talking about building it into the salary, so would that be – so you could still basically give the bonus, if I understand you correctly, not as a bonus where they're going to get, but as you see, it could go up, not necessarily wait till the end of the year like we're used to most contracts being 2% in step, but you could actually make, I guess, goals for better ways of doing it within the contract that would not be counted as a bonus.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, we haven't actually looked at how we would do that. There's one alternative I think that we probably have thought of more extensively is simply explaining to the various applicants for a marketing lead for the state of Alaska would be to say there isn't a bonus structure, but instead we're giving you a higher base salary.
Thank you.
Munoz followed by Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I want to get back to the withdrawal agreements and the information that we received this morning from Analytica, which was distributed, pointed out that withdrawal agreements at this stage in the process carry significant risk, major risk for the state of Alaska. And the reason for that is that the right to purchase at this point could result in an obligation to buy later on and would result possibly in an additional billions of dollars in costs to the state of Alaska. So my question is on the list of agreements to be negotiated and why the withdrawal agreement on the second page is not one of those agreements that would come back to the legislature for approval.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, I'm sorry, you meant the second page of the handout?
Yes, ma'am. We have a list of agreements to be negotiated, and many of the agreements that obligate the state greater than 2 years will require legislative authority.
Representative Munoz, through the chairs, actually that's something that we are, one of the, it's the primary reason that we put at the top of the, these two pages, it's our current understanding. It is, since these agreements are being negotiated currently, we think that they would not in and by themselves commit the state to anything for a long term. It would just be a structure by which they've agreed, you know, how they would handle their withdrawal, but a gas sales agreement, you'll note, does require legislative approval. So unless things change, the withdrawal agreement doesn't bind the state necessarily to anything. So that's why we currently have it shown as a no. But should the withdrawal agreement evolve or change and begin to bind the state to something, obviously that would then require legislative approval.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think I think committing to the state to any price at this stage in the game is probably not in our best interest. So I would advise that we have an opportunity to review and approve those agreements. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add something here. There are actually two withdrawal agreements. There's the withdrawal agreement that is associated with withdrawing agreement out of the governance structure. Now, if we're talking about that withdrawal, then in fact that would be coming to the legislature as part of the governance, although let me think, AGDC has actually got the governance, so. And then there's the withdrawal agreement that's associated with if they decide to remove themselves and still supply either the gas through a tolling agreement or a gas sales agreement. So that's the reason this is a little, we're not precisely clear on that. It's not that we're hiding anything. It's just it's an evolving commercial agreement, and we're not sure yet what that will look like.
That just further affirms my belief that we need to take a second look at those agreements when they come back. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Part of the structured process, I believe, that we're looking at. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, actually now I'm a bit more confused than I was before. My questions, I'm going to ask Marty if you can kind of clarify that last statement before I ask my questions. I'm looking on page 2 of the handout, the bottom here where it says withdrawal agreement. And where's the other one you were referring to? Please.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, do you mind if I take a swipe at this? So the withdrawal agreement itself is would likely be an agreement signed by AGDC because it governs It governs the structure of the relationship between the parties. It's a government's document, so that's why it says it says no here is my understanding.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I might add something to that, Representative Sadler, the document from Analytica talks about withdrawal and sales and purchase agreement. If you'll notice on page, where's gas supply agreement upon withdrawal on the fourth line at the second page of the handout. That one, you'll notice, does require legislative approval. So anything that commits the state to any arrangements associated with supply of gas by a withdrawing party would have to come back to the state. This lower one that's third from the bottom on that second page is actually just part of that governance agreement, again, with AGDC.
Okay, well then my question, I have not asked my questions at all yet. I was trying to clarify hers. So each of these, Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, envisions execution by the fourth quarter 2015. That's about 8 weeks. Do you have confidence that you can get either or both of these completed by the end of this year? Actually, by December 4th, so much less than about 5 weeks. Can you get this done in time?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think it's a very significant challenge.
That's a maybe. I will stipulate that it is a challenge, so that there's a question as to whether it can be done. So that leads to my initial question, actually. We all share the desire of making progress on this, but I've got developing concerns that the focus on protecting the exit ramp is going to lead us to failure and not progress to success. So to seek another clarity in the question, will the administration support going forward with this process with a vote yes on the work program and budget on December 4th if either or both of these withdrawal agreements have not been signed before December 4th? I guess that would be for the Attorney General.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think that that's something that you should probably ask AGDC or the governor, because they're ultimately the policy decision makers.
With respect, sir, I'd like to know your answer.
My answer is I don't know the answer. Right? I mean, because I don't make that decision. So obviously the governor and AGDC have created the governor's created an expectation that we'll have these documents done by December 4th. Two of our partner companies have committed to that same. That's a very good thing for the state. I think everyone agrees that we should work towards those goals, and the consequences of not meeting them are something that will be faced at the time.
You said, follow up? Thank you, sir. You had said earlier in response to the co-chair's question that you would not advise the governor what to do, only what he could do. My question to you, sir, is can the governor make the decision to withhold administrative support of the work plan and budget absent approval of either or both of those withdrawal agreements?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, AGDC can make that decision if the approval of TransCanada goes through. If TransCanada is still in the deal, then the governor would have the authority through DNR to make that decision.
Could you clarify that? I didn't follow that. That's a little complicated.
Sure. Representative Sadler, through the chair, currently the way it's structured is the state of Alaska gets TransCanada, gets to direct TransCanada's vote for the work plan and budget. If TransCanada is not in the deal, then that vote will be directed by AGDC. It will be their vote. So it will ultimately be AGDC's vote and the vote of their board.
Okay. And as I understand it, the structure, follow up, you are the general counsel for AGDC. So my question to you is, you answered first that the question can be, yes, they can make that a condition. Yep. Would it be your advice to your client, AGDC's board, that they should reject the work plan and budget absent a withdrawal agreement?
Representative Sadler, it would not be my advice to my client reject it or not reject it.
So that's a no?
Yes, Representative Sadler, that's
your advice to AGDC would be that they should reject it absent the withdrawal agreements.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, no, I'm not going to give the advice to my client either way what they should or should not do in relation to the strategic decisions that the board makes. What I would do is I would tell them that they have the option, if they choose legally not to go forward with the work plan and budget, just like all of the producer companies have the option to not approve the work plan and budget.
Okay. So, nicely, I'm trying to pin you down as to what your advice would be, and you're not giving it. So, okay, I can't make you do that. But I'm concerned that this withdrawal agreement is going to be a sticking point that's going to prompt a decision not to proceed with the project, and I'm getting no assurance from you that that's not going to happen. I offer the opportunity to persuade me otherwise.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I can't give you an absolute guarantee that decision won't be made by my client, but I can tell you that everyone is working very, very hard and in good faith and with a lot of diligence to move this project forward, to get the very aggressive agreement schedule done in the time that we need to do to get the constitutional amendment approved, and this piece of it is part of that. And I believe personally that I believe BP and Conoco and what they said, and I believe we can get those agreements done, and I believe that we'll go forward with them.
To follow up then, thank you. Mr. Attorney General, what message would it send to you as a big player in this project if one of the producers decides to not commit to this program?
What message would it send? Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think it would send the message that one or more of our producer partners is maintaining an option not to have North Slope gas developed.
And what if two were to give you that decision?
I think it would send the message that two of our partners are considering the option not to have North Slope gas developed.
Touché. Are there other conditions, thank you, are there any other conditions that the administration might place on approval of the work plan and program going forward at that December 4th? We've heard the gas agreements. Lord, I'm going to listen to the transcript to see what the answer was, but I think I heard the answer is yes, those will be conditions. Are there other conditions?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'm not aware of any statements by AGDC or the governor's office or by DNR or any of the major decision makers in this project that have conditions like you're suggesting?
With respect, sir, you would be in a position to know. You've told me you're not aware of any.
I'm not aware of any, Representative Satter.
Anybody else in AGDC be aware of any as their attorney?
So I'm not aware of any, which means no one's told me, so I don't know of any other any conditions or anything like that, Representative Sadler.
I can do no more. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's just great questions, really good responses to the extent that we can get, responses can be provided. And it just seems to me, before I get to a couple of questions that I wanted to ask, that, the real there's a very real possibility that this timeline is going to slip. I mean, that there are just external factors that we can't control that are going to cause some kind of deviation from what's in front of us here, and we're going to have to just live with that and do the best we can to go forward. But that said, it's also very, just occurs to me that one of the bigger values that the special session is providing are, among the other valuable attributes, is the fact that we have a legislature that's, for the most part, and I'd like to thank all the non-members who have very diligently sat through these meetings day after day, but we're getting a legislature that's getting up to snuff on the particulars of a very complicated issue with a lot of different moving parts from every possible angle you can imagine. But that said, to my question, I'm kind of fast-forwarding the next session. We're looking at one heck of a session coming up. Holy smacks. I mean, historic by many proportions. Big deficits, the sovereign wealth fund concept in front of us, maybe a special session on constitutional amendment and so forth, as best I can tell it. But what's the overall strategy here for keeping us as a legislature on point on some of these issues that, we may know in December kind of what direction we're going based on what events happen or don't happen, but we're going to have a legislature that's going to be grappling with a lot of different things, and with constituents back home who are fundamentally trying to change their mindset vis-a-vis paying consultants $840,000, vis-a-vis entering into the 25-year binding agreements for freezing of tax rates, things that have been anathema to a lot of Alaskans and a lot of legislators in the past. So we got some fundamental turns here to take politically coming up in the next few months. So what's the how are we moving forward in this in terms of, from a strategic perspective?
Representative Edgman, through the chair, Marty Rutherford, Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner. You're right. It is there are many significant issues in front of you over the course of the next 6 months, and what it is my expectation that we would actually deal with these subsequently. You would actually probably end up dealing with more of the fiscal issues during the regular session, and then a special session following that. That is my sense that the best we could do. Obviously, we're working very hard to try to bring closure to the agreements as quickly as we can. But one of the things that we will do is we'll work very hard to have clear and concise analysis provided to you for each of the agreements so that, in fact, you will have a lot of experts available to you who can walk you through each of the documents and help you understand the relationship between the various documents and what the implications are. We'll also have a lot of analytics available for you so that you can understand the financial implications. That doesn't mean that this is going to be simple, because you well understand it is not, but we will do everything in our power to provide as much clarity as possible. Not unlike, if you will, the Alaska Gasline Inducement Act exercise that we went through years ago, where we provided continuing forms with a lot of the experts being made directly available to you.
Yeah, so just as a follow-up, you know, I'm willing to commit that I will work very hard with my constituents to understand why we have to pay market rates to get the top-level talent in terms of, you know, marketing leads or whoever else that we need to get on board this project. I do have a little bit of private sector experience, and I've been party to recruiting in the private sector, and it's a little more than what legislators get paid, for sure, and a good many people in this room get paid, so we have to deal with that reality. And as well, on the 20 to 25-year commitment, I guess my last point would be that, you know, if I have any takeaway 25 years from now, if I'm still around about the special session, it really is going to be the value of having good working relationships between the producers and the state, because if we don't have that, this thing isn't going forward. No matter how many may want to villainize the state or the producers or any of us, we have to work together to get this going forward. So that would be my commitment. And, Mr. Chairman, I'll yield the microphone at this point.
Representative. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to ask a couple questions about, and going back a little bit to the withdrawal agreements and whatnot, and actually looking at the timelines or the handout that we have here. In the handout that we had, the very first page was the preliminary agreement back from when SB 138 was in front of us. And it does not list as one of the others, does not list the withdrawal agreement in there as one of the kind of must-haves. And I understand it was a preliminary. But now we have it as it seems like it's a must. And what I'm trying to understand is what has changed over the last, you know, 18 months or so that has made that a must-have for us, that it's on our timeline of a requirement to get us to the point where we get to a where we get to a constitutional amendment.
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, Marty Rutherford, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. Everyone brings their own perspective of risk when they look at a project of this magnitude. And one of the things that this administration feels is that if you progress a project, you settle on all the commercial agreements, you fix fiscal certainty for a duration of 25 years, and you end up 2 years from now, and one or more of the parties pulls the plug and says, geez, sorry, we're not going to progress this project any further, and oh, by the way, we're not going to provide your gas to this project. The economics of the project significantly change. Volume is a driver in the cost of the gas. So if you lost all of one party's gas or all of one unit, you basically have to go back to the drawing board for whether this project is economic. So this administration feels that everything it can do to bring some certainty that the gas will be available is in the state's best interest. I think that the two parties that have sent letters to the administration saying that they're committed to try to negotiate these agreements recognize that this is a risk to the state, and they've certainly indicated their willingness to try to provide some certainty around that. And so I don't see that as a bad thing. Obviously, what the details of those agreements look like will be critically important to the state. And so my comment is only that I think it's a little premature at this juncture to presume we're going to do any one thing since we're just in the process of these negotiations. And certainly I don't think anybody would question the fact that the more gas and the lower the tariff and the more money we can make at the wellhead is in the state's interest. So that's all that we're trying to do, is to accomplish that commitment, get that commitment in some form.
So, but one of the things that I'm struggling with is if Conoco or BP, if either one of them feel comfortable with withdrawing, then it's not in the state's interest, because they're willing to sell it at a point where they feel they can get the best value for the shareholders, therefore making it a struggle for us to make this project economical. So can we really hold on to the fact that we've had to commit to say, yeah, we'll go ahead and work on a withdrawal? I don't think I really want them at this stage telling me that they're willing to work on a withdrawal. Am I missing something? Are they not going to try to get the most for that gas that they are going to, we are going to be purchasing from them in a withdrawal agreement?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, do you mind if I respond?
Sure.
So I think that maybe what's being missed is that the gas sales agreement is going to be an option for the state. So it's not like we will pre-commit to buying the gas on specific terms with 100% certainty if some point in the future somebody withdraws. It's that at that withdrawal event, the state will have the option to get the gas, or the other producer parties will have the option to get the gas at pre-agreed terms. So that's why when I looked at this analysis for Analytica, you know, some of it I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with, because we're creating an option. We're not creating something we have to do. Is the object behind the negotiations.
So, follow up. Can you tell me how far along we are in those discussions?
So, like, all of this stuff, all this stuff being the commercial agreements, the discussions have been going on in different forms and different paces for, well, since before this administration came into office. So the withdrawal agreements, those discussions have been occurring for 6 months that I'm aware of.
So is it, Mr. Chair? So are we at the point where we can fit in with our timeline, where we'll have it done by the end of the year? I mean, I know the two have said that they'll work with us, but you're still missing one big player, and they have a lot of gas.
Representative Pruitt, it's my hope that we can get there with all three companies.
Well, another company.
But can I guarantee it? No, I can't guarantee that we'll make any timeline with any agreement, because every party negotiating has the power not to advance every single agreement.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I'll use a quote that one of my vice presidents at a company I used to use, and that's hope's not a method. And I think we're doing a little bit of that here. We're hoping that some of these things are going to come together. And this is a timeline that's very close on a few things, and we've got 8 weeks out here. So I guess the next question would be, what's contingency? What happens if we don't hit these very tight timelines? What if you don't get the withdrawal agreements, which weren't a priority a year and a half ago to the state, and I understand there's change in administration. What happens if those things do not come into place? Are we going to be able to continue on the road to that constitutional amendment?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I think the Attorney General said that he cannot speak for the governor, neither can I. This timeline recognizes there might be slippage. What it does is it just increases the pressures on the subsequent quarters. I think that one of the things I don't think we've actually discussed is the fact that many of these agreements are progressed very far, some of them more than others, I think that there are a couple of elements that if they fall into place, they would free up the opportunity to close on many other agreements. And I will say right now, gas balancing is one of those. So once that is in place, I think many other things will begin to clarify very quickly. So it's not like they're all at a starting point. They're not. They're all progressed fairly far, some of them very close to the end, some of them, I'd say, at a midpoint. So it's not impossible at all if every party is motivated to find that middle ground. I think it is possible, but it's challenging. I won't pretend it's not.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. So I guess the next question is the state organized in a manner which we will not be the hindrance to those items going forward?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I think the state has very good quality people on the teams. And I think that as things begin to solidify around some of the sort of threshold issues, I think we are structured well enough to close. We've added, as you know, and Attorney General Richards has spoken about it and probably will some more today, about some of the additional costs associated with some of the legal fees. We brought on another law firm named Milbank, and I never can remember their entire name, but they are an outstanding law firm. They bring a lot of value to us, and I think they will allow us to craft the documents quickly and expertly. The teams are well set up. We've got good people on them, and I think that we can reach closure, yes.
So, and I want to make it clear, that's a yes?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, yes, it is my opinion we will not be a barrier. The state of Alaska will not be a barrier to reaching these agreements, except to the degree that we are protecting the state's interest and not allowing a poor commercial agreement go forward.
Yeah, final question, Mr. Chair. And then I want to highlight one thing that I've heard you guys say a couple times, and it's kind of been a theme. You said you wouldn't speak for the governor. And there's a lot of people here that are representing the governor that say they won't speak for the governor. So short of getting the governor in here, is there anyone that can really be clear on some of these things that we're asking? And I guess that's one of the frustrations, and I hope you understand. Legislature's a little frustrated because we're trying to find some answers, and we're either hearing, I can't answer that, that's AGDC. AGDC has done the same thing, and we're trying to just understand what the direction is going forward, because we're not just talking about the $157 million we're talking about in this bill. This is a discussion about this project going forward, and we need some clarity.
Representative Pruitt, through the chairs, I'm going to tell you that the administration is totally committed to making this work. We are committed to getting the agreements in place and getting them to you by 2016 so that we can progress this project. Many things could derail that, but I believe absolutely we are intending to abide by a very compressed timeline as long as we can protect the state's interest. So we are committed to 138, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have a couple more questions. So I just want to focus on, go back to page 5 while you're doing this. Or 15, excuse me. 15. Commissioner, I just want to go back to what you just said, is the state's very committed to moving this forward in a positive fashion. When we created Senate Bill 138, we asked several different advisory groups, global people who are globally known, to help us set up the structure within 138, because it was very specific to a very specific job. Part of that process was to ensure that we could do the best that we could to try and keep politics out of it. Because at the time, what we were told, and we received again further testimony this year, that probably the greatest risk that the producers could get engaged in within the state of Alaska, with the state, with any government, is the fact that it's a government. We're not a business with a contract, and the insecurities that can bring. And that's why the structure, at least my opinion and the belief, was the fact that in 138, it was very specifically designed to set up a very specific program in the steps, in a stage-gated process, which we are in. And we approve that. That is the law. The process in 138 is the law. There's nothing in there on gas withdrawal and balance, or gas withdrawals at this time, on a December 15th date, and the timeline is for a specific reason. Part of those reasons were the fact that we would not have that amount of information that we would need to have to enter into complicated and complex contracts with the producers on withdrawal agreements. Just in the economics on that, one of the answers every time we asked the Analytica folks, we asked them just this morning on withdrawal agreements again, asked about this, and he said the first thing he said, if Exxon tried to sell you gas, would you buy it? And they said, we would advise you not to do it, because if they want to sell you gas, you could probably get a better deal. I mean, you just wouldn't want to buy their gas. Besides, we already have a bunch of gas. So with that, when we look at the economics of why they would not want to do that and the complexities that would enter into a withdrawal agreement and the cost that it could substantially put the state into in future years, what is the process? I'll back up with two steps. So if you get into a gas sales agreement, you need to know your transportation costs, what you're going to do with CO2, reinjection, gas treatment for gas liquefaction, those types of costs before you can move forward, correct? So would those types of contracts have to be negotiated? Where do you see that happening in this process, in the stage-gated process that was set up?
Mr. Chairman, Marty Rutherford, Department of Natural Resources, Deputy Commissioner. As indicated on this handout, we see that the sales agreement would be submitted to the legislature for approval. And again, I think that the Attorney General clarified something that's critical to this. It's not, we see this as an option. If, in fact, a withdrawing party says that we are going to step away from this project and they've got agreement with us that here's the terms under which we would sell our gas, it's an option that the state would consider. But prior to that, as part of all the package of commercial agreements that will be brought to you for approval, those specifics on what those terms are will also be provided, and the legislature can determine whether or not having that as an option is actually in the state's interest. So it's all part of the same things. You are absolutely correct. The state of Alaska needs to know under what terms it will deal with its disposal of CO2. It actually has to have agreements in place so that you can make an informed decision on what the economics of our gas will be, just like field cost allowance and gas supply terms and, you know, all the firm transportation service agreement with AGDC, if TransCanada is out. All of those things are critical to understanding the risk and reward the state of Alaska will deal with. But part of that package, hopefully, will be sales agreement offers from the companies that provide us an option should that situation occur in the future where one of the equity owners, one of the producer companies, decides to step away from the project.
Is it would a right to purchase mean an obligation to buy?
Representative Newman, Mr. Chairman, no.
A right to purchase would not mean an obligation to buy?
Representative Newman, that's the current understanding of the status of the negotiations from the state's perspective.
So if an entity has the right to purchase their gas, they enter into that purchasing agreement, do they have an obligation to buy that?
Mr. Chairman, the current expectation under the negotiations is there would not be an obligation to buy at this time. Now, at some point in time in the future, when the state made the decision to exercise the option, that would then create binding commitments where you would have, you know, potentially the obligation to take the gas. But it would only be in the future when you elected to exercise the option.
Do we know what the price of gas is going to be?
No, Mr. Chairman. I would say if I knew that, I'd be working in a hedge fund in Wall Street.
Do we know the volume of gas?
Representative Newman, we don't know the exact volume, but we have an idea, just like we have an idea for the project. So there's parameters of understanding. I think there's a little less understanding about the volume in Point Thompson than potentially Prudhoe Bay, but we have, you know, parameters.
So if you've got, if gas has an option attached to it, is there a legal title to that?
Representative Newman, Mr. Chairman, legal title would not transfer until such time as you took the physical possession of any particular molecule. So the title rests with the molecule.
So I'm trying to figure out how you could enter into a withdrawal agreement until you knew that. those were steps that you would have to know to enter into a withdrawal agreement.
Mr. Chairman, I think that it's pretty standard in gas sales agreements that you kind of, funneling is the term that's used, where you recognize that there are some things that are not absolutely certain. Volume is the classic example, right? So what you do is you set up in your gas sales agreements sort of a funneling mechanism over time, that the closer you get to capital commitments within the field and within the project for infrastructure, you're getting more and more clarity around the volumes. So I think it's pretty rare that the gas sales agreements are absolutely firm as to volumes at any point until you kind of follow this funneling stage to the point where you're actually starting construction.
So, Mr. Richards, have you personally went and examined any of the gas contracts on any gas pipelines in the world yet? Have you examined any of them?
Mr. Chairman, I have not examined any of them for the purposes of this exercise, but I have certainly reviewed them in the past for other reasons.
The reason I ask that is because you said that that's a standard.
So, Representative Newman, I was told that that was a standard practice by one of our counsel, one of the Milbank attorneys that is working on this.
I've asked every one of the producers so far, and Analytica, some of our people that advise us, if they've ever heard of a withdrawal agreement such as the state of Alaska is offering or asking for, and was told no. So I don't know what. Well, I'm trying to figure out how you could feel it's standard policy.
Representative Newman, I was referring to the funneling mechanism to get certainty around the volumes in the gas sales agreements, is what I understood was standard.
I'm trying to figure out in contract where you've ever seen at this point in a stage-gated process in a pipeline where any entity has asked its partners to enter into a withdrawal agreement that says if you drop out as one of the partners, that you forego everything that you put into this. Have you ever seen that contract or that language in any other gas pipeline proposals?
Representative Newman, I have not, but I have also not personally been privy to the commercial arrangements around other LNG projects. So
you're the kind of guy who does your homework. You're a smart guy. I understand that, and I respect that. It's one of your known attributes that you like details. I'm just surprised, and this is more of a statement, I guess, for myself, that if somebody told you that it's standard policy, why you may not have asked for copies of withdrawal agreements that you've seen in other contracts that you could use as a boilerplate. And have you asked for that, or have you seen anything like that?
So, Representative Newman, I think that I haven't asked because the circumstances, I guess, in my mind were very particular to Alaska in terms of progressing this project in this dynamic. And the withdrawal agreement that I see getting negotiated is going to be pretty simple, actually. The complexity is in the gas sales arrangements and that option that we're talking about. And that is one area where certainly there has been and will continue to be discussion among all the lawyers and the commercial parties what are customary practices around the world.
Can you tell us your vision of what you would see in a standard, what you would feel would be a standard withdrawal agreement?
Representative Newman, so I think that we've identified the main elements, which is if a party leaves AKLNG or is unwilling to progress it, that and they withdraw, that gas sales are made available. And that's really the core of it, that an option will exist to have that gas available for a project.
And Attorney General Richards, the point is when that happens. So you've got this dated that this needs to happen. We heard the Deputy Commissioner say that this is a very high on their priority of a must-have with gas withdrawal agreements by December 15th. Yet, I took it seriously what you're trying to do, and I did my best to try and find out is it standard in the industry? The answer was no. Is it standard in any gas pipelines in the state? Was there any known withdrawal agreements that were fashioned similar to this in any other gas pipeline contracts in the world? And I was told not that they were aware of. And you know, we can only base on what we know for knowledge and what we're trying to get on. And particularly, so when we asked, is there an opportunity for this into the future? I asked, is there an opportunity in this future? And he said, yes, but you'd have to know what the price of your gas is, what your volumes are. There's certain things that you would have to know before you could ever negotiate that. And we're a long, long ways from knowing any of that information for December 15th. Do you agree? I mean, you've been advising. You're more in the know.
So, Mr. Chairman, certainly it would be nice to have more information soon. But I will say that the gas sales agreement as an option for the state in the future creates substantially less risk than some of the other decisions that are being made, in particular whether or not we take gas royalty in kind versus royalty in value and modify our leases for the net profit interests. Those are decisions that are under this process are being made within, you know, a couple months after potentially the withdrawal agreements, and those are things that we're committing to as non-option. Those are things that really commit are massive economic commitments early on the front end of this project, and that's the nature of the process we're in. And you know, everybody wants to hold off and make all of the economic decisions as absolutely as late as possible. That's good business decisions, but the process we're in has us making some pretty key decisions over the next 4 to 6 months, including whether or not and to what extent we're going to bind our tax framework for the next 25 years. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, this is just a way of me saying that more clarity around things like pricing, on volumes, on tariff levels, all of those would be wonderful things to have before we negotiated a gas purchase option. But they would also be wonderful things to have before we committed to modify our leases or to alter our constitution to lock ourselves in on taxes. But we're in the timeline we're in.
I understand we're in the timeline as you're in. But again, I'm going to this, what you stated is 12/2015 with the things that have to be done according to the Alaska LNG timeline. And we didn't hear the folks from Alaska LNG tell us anything about their timeline and why it. I had never heard anything from the AKLNG team, project management team, that of all the parties or AKLNG or anybody else besides the administration here mentioned this, and that's I'm just trying to find that information on. So, again, the information that would be needed on that and the timing of when it would have to be done is calling into question. So let's focus on risk. We've also been told that because this gas wall withdrawal agreements have been brought up, in the uncertainty, particularly with the timeline requested on this, that this adds risk to the project. Do you agree that it has risks?
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I guess whenever you interject anything new into negotiation process, it adds risk in the form of additional complexity. But I certainly think the point of the agreements is to reduce overall risk by creating clarity for the state and for the other producer parties that if any one party does withdraw in the future, that the project can continue. So it does enhance a little bit of negotiating risk, but I would say it reduces, and if done successfully, which we believe it will reduce substantially more risk than it creates.
My concern here is because it's added further risk, it's added increased costs. We've heard that cost certainty is one of the major proponents to any gas pipeline. And the ability to try and keep this cost down to the maximum, to the lowest cost possible, is going to make this the highest probability of happening. And when we have things that were stepped outside the law, Senate Bill 138 is the law that created the structure for the negotiating for a gas pipeline. It's been through years of work, starting with House Bill 4, Senate Bill 138, and why this very specific structure that we have today does not include withdrawal agreements by the end of 2015, because that's what the law says. And so when you add things that are the negotiating term or a negotiating tool indiscriminately into a timeline adds risks. Those risks will increase costs, which makes Alaska's gas much more or less probable on the world market. My concern is it makes getting a gas pipeline much less probable. And from my understanding, it adds a tremendous amount of risk. Then we have the fact that we ask people who do this every day, people who advise nations what to do. Never seen a withdrawal agreements like this. It's not particularly at this time. And then we said, okay, if we did it at this time, they brought up their concerns about why the costs were. And what I did when I went down through your question is basically paraphrase what they were telling us here. And I don't think we'd be served an appropriate answer as to why the risk evaluation against the cost has been determined, why the state would be in an advantage on that.
Mr. Chairman, I think I can summarize it just very shortly that the state's risk profile is substantially reduced if it knows all of Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson volumes will be available for the project as designed in the future. It means that 3 years from now, if a party withdraws, we don't have to change the design basis, we don't have to make a smaller project, we don't have to start over on permitting. You know, our engineering is set. I mean, it lets us, if successful, the gas sales agreements will provide an avenue where we have more certainty that the project as designed goes forward.
I believe a gas sales agreement would do that. That's why I think you have to have a gas sales agreement of what you're going to sell your gas for before you have to have a withdrawal agreement. And I believe that's what you said.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, they're currently, the thought process is currently that they'll be done simultaneously.
It certainly is. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to remind all the members that we have publicized statewide that we're going to have public testimony on HB 3001 starting at 4 p.m. There'll be people in the LIOs and people calling in, so just as a reminder. I don't know. This is a question and a statement, possibly. We've asked the administration, different segments of the administration, if there is no withdrawal agreement with Exxon prior to December 4th, how would the state vote at that December 4th meeting for the budget and work plan going into the future? And we haven't been able to get an answer. Nobody will say yes or no or whatever. And this is very bothersome because Steve Butt from Exxon, who is the lead person on the project management team, has stated to us, and we've heard it from other people, and he stated it more than once in legislative hearings in the last week, that December 4th vote is critical. If there is anybody votes no, if the state votes no on December 4th, this project halts completely. It's done. Everybody's going to be sent home to wherever they're from. And this is very bothersome. And it looks to me like if we end up with the state voting no on December 4th, that my personal opinion, some of the other people here in this room's personal opinions, a lot of my constituents, that the failure of this project will then be on the administration, and that the legislature will have given the administration all the tools that they need to move forward on a successful project. I'm very concerned about where we are and why are we spending majority of our time planning for failure instead of being positive and looking at this project with a positive attitude that we're going forward.
Chairman Thompson, if I might, Marty Rutherford, DNR Deputy Commissioner. We are committed to the success on this project. I think it's fair to say, without getting too specific, that all the AKLNG parties are involved in the withdrawal discussions. And I think everyone at that table is committed to trying to move this project forward and to ensure that should one party, for whatever reasons, perhaps financial reasons, at some point in time decide they do not want to be an asset owner, they are committed to trying to ensure that the project can progress, and that is the goal, truly. We will, we're doing everything we can to abide by the time frame that we laid out, and we think our partners are trying to do the same. And I think that's what those letters from the two companies said we're really suggesting to the public, to Alaskans, that they're committed to trying to make this work, and that should something change in the future and they decide to withdraw, that they have provided the state an option that they can choose to exercise at that time. But truly, we are committed to this project being successful. I think it's going to be extremely difficult next couple of quarters, but I think our intention is to bring you contracts that you can support by spring 2016. So truly, that is our commitment to you. We're trying to get there.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. We had to take care of a little bit of other business here. So I think what I just wanted to echo what Representative Thompson said is focusing on success. We set up a structure under 138 where we entered into agreements with our partners based on the structure of 138. Now there's been a different component entered into the whole discussion called withdrawal agreements and a date put on them by December 15th, or just the end of December of 2015. We've had the Attorney General say that his advice to the governor could be probably one of two things, either to continue on if that's not done, or to terminate this whole project. That's the only other options there is. That causes me a tremendous amount of concern. With that, we were scheduled, and we are scheduled, and we will do public testimony from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. I don't know. Public testimony may want to try and carry on longer than that. They were scheduled to be here from 1:30 to 4. They were tied up over in the other body for a while. They got here as soon as they could. We will ask them if they would be willing to come back later. I don't know what their schedules are or what they are doing later after public testimony. So with that, we will adjourn to the call of the chair.
Recess.